Welcome to Gospel Tangents. I'm your host, Rick Bennett. Please consider donating or purchasing a transcript by going to our website, gospeltangents.com/shop. You'll help support other documentaries and podcasts such as this. I asked BYU professor Dr. Richard Bennett to talk about some of the biggest changes in temple practices between 1890 and the present. Let's listen in our conversation.
So kind of what I'm looking at, in Kirtland you have the you've got the Kirtland Endowment, and then in Nauvoo you've got baptism for the dead, and you've got the Nauvoo Endowment and ceilings. St. George, you have, okay, we're getting rid of the law of adoption. Are there any other kind of theological changes going on between, 1890 and now?
The doctrine of the gathering. Temples were magnets and were a powerful factor in people gathering from Europe and England to the Rocky Mountains, or originally even to Nauvoo. The saints want to be where the temple is. After 1900 and the beginning of an understanding that we should stay where we are and gather to the local units and gather in your own nations, you begin to see temples now moving out from Utah. I think the first major expression of that would be the Cardston Temple.
Is that under President McKay?
No, that's back in the 19-teens. It's going to be in Joseph Smith's time. I'm trying to remember the exact date of the Cardston Temple. But to actually build a temple in another country, that the people would gather there, is a signal of changing place of temples as a gathering force for the church in different nations. And of course, the whole story of temples in modern times has been building temples where the saints are, especially under President Hinckley. They are to gather to the temples in their own nations. President McKay with New Zealand, England, and Swiss temples, the international growth of the church, gathering to your own, in your own nations where the temples are. And you're seeing the temples going to where the people are rather than the people coming to where the temple is. That's a major change in the whole story of the growth of Mormonism.
So you say that started in about 1910?
Certainly with the Cardston Temple.
Okay. And then the 50s was, I believe, New Zealand, is that right?
56, we're looking at, that was the L.A. Temple, and then 50, just right around that same time, the New Zealand and the Swiss temples, David O. McKay. And then it has just compounded ever since.
And then President Hinckley just went like a rocket.
Yes, under President Hinckley, there's no question that the internationalization of the church, President McKay's vision of it, really solidifies it with him, and the taking of the temple to where the people are. But this thing about the gathering, the doctrine of gathering in the temples, goes clear back to Kirtland. That's why they were gathering there, was because of the temple. That's why they gathered to Nauvoo, all the saints coming from England, right? And that's why they're gathering to the Rocky Mountains, because the temple is a very, very... It wasn't only an economic reason for them gathering. There was no question about the economic factor. It's going to be maybe a better life than we had in Devonshire, in those days. But the spiritual aspect of it is going to be the temple. And are we going to give up this for whatever reason? You see what I mean?
Yeah. In Greg Prince's biography on President McKay, there was a very interesting story about a proposal for a temple ship. Do you know that story very well?
I know the story. Like a hope ship. It had a lot of traction at one time. Pretty hard to keep sacred a ship, though. And I think that was the thing that sunk it. The idea that, we can have this boat that would be a dedicated temple. And it had the reason it had traction is that it could go to places where the saints were. You could go to the islands and different countries all over the world. But I think they were... I don't know. I remember studying that when I was studying the life of David O. McKay years ago. when I wrote the history of Brigham Young University, Shadow wrote the history, that this is going to be difficult to keep a ship afloat that's a temple and keep it sacred going all over the place and having it serviced and everything else, plus the cost.
Do you think, what was the bigger issue? Was it the cost?
Or? I can't tell you. I don't know. It's a combination of those and other factors.
Well, as I recall, I believe it was President Dyer was concerned because there's that scripture in the Doctrine and Covenants about
the waters.
Yeah.
I don't know if that was so much a factor, but I think it was a combination of how we're going to keep something like that sacred and how we're going to keep it, how we're going to finance it. And it didn't have the gathering impulse also, which the Swiss temple had for the Swiss folks in Europe, or the New Zealand temple had for the folks in New Zealand. You know, it didn't have that permanency that we're here to stay. And I think that was probably the bigger factor, the gathering factor.
Do you have any last thoughts about the temple and temple development?
Well, we didn't get into the whole idea that temples preceded the Kirtland Temple. The whole doctrine of the temples go clear back to the beginning. You know, it's been there from the beginning. It wasn't a later overlay. I think you could clearly make the argument that Moroni taught temples with his Turning the Hearts of the Fathers of the Children, 1823. Sister Beck makes that point in one of her talks very, very well, that the doctrine of eternal salvation for the dead goes clear back to Moroni, glad tidings from Cumorah. And, you know, there's that clear... I make the argument in this forthcoming book that there was a clear connection between the very, very beginning of Mormonism and what's happening in temple work today. It's the same church as it was from the very beginning. Contrary to some critics say, oh, gee, we're hardly the same church at all. By looking at plural marriage, you might argue that. But if you look at temple work and how it developed and how it was understood by those early leaders of the church, I think I make the argument, and I think it's very clear that it was there from, it was in our DNA from the start.
Oh, great. Well, I thank you for letting me take your afternoon here.
Yeah. I'll send you a bill.
So, anyway, once again, thank you for participating in the Gospel Tangents, and I'll have to make another appointment. We'll talk about the secession crisis next time.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Rick.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to thank BYU Church History Professor Dr. Richard Bennett for spending so much time with us and talking about the evolution of temple worship over the years. I hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as I did. In our next conversation, we're going to move to the University of Memphis and Dr. Darren Smith. He's recently written a book about how race and religion collide. In our next conversation, we'll talk about Tim Tebow and Jeremy Lin and the media portrayals of them. It seems like the media has some stereotypes that you may not consider naturally.
So Tebow can pull it off, or Tebow is celebrated for his Christianity, and someone like Jeremy Lin, who is also deeply Christian, I would even argue probably more Christian than Tebow because he's so humble about it. He doesn't parade it around, but we weren't interested in that. With that aspect of his identity, Lin's identity, but Tebow's identity, it just fit his identity because that's the narrative that we typically hear about, at least in the South, of what a football player should be, someone like Tim Tebow.
Click here to subscribe, click here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some other videos that we've done here on YouTube. We hope you'll use this as a valuable resource to learn more about Mormon history.